Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, episode 143, Inciting Meg Ellison's Riot. I am so excited to bring you guys an interview with returning friend of the show, author Meg Ellison. Her latest book, Finding Layla, comes out this month. It's actually already out, I think, by the time this show comes out, and is going to be available everywhere books are sold. It's an interesting time trying to promote a book during quarantine. I know my own book, While I Wait to Be a God Again, came out earlier this year, and it is such an interesting time to try to promote books during a quarantine. So I had a really fun chat with Meg about what it means to not just promote books during a quarantine, but to write diverse characters, to write interesting, dynamic, in her case, post-apocalyptic fiction. To write authentic stories featuring diverse characters that feel authentic and real and that don't fall into tropes, that don't turn people who have very real, very lived experience into, a stereotype. So it's certainly an eye-opening discussion for me, and I hope for you as well. If you are a budding author and you have questions about writing diverse characters to write like what the world is, I think that this conversation is going to be for you and really for anybody that wants to be a creator of any kind. We also spend a good deal of time talking about the body positivity and fat acceptance movement. The topic of self-love, self-care, of body acceptance is one that is near and dear to my heart as someone that grew up plagued by body dysmorphia. I am so incredibly honored and humbled that Meg gave us the gift of her emotional labor here to talk about these topics in such a real and beautiful and raw way. So I hope that you guys enjoy this. Just remember, Patreon supporters heard this show first. I know that right now, not a lot of folks have a lot of money to give. And for anybody that is continuing to support independent pagan media via as little as a dollar a month, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. However, as I've been saying the last several episodes, if you have the dollar to give and it's your only dollar to give, I would much rather that dollar be going to frontline professionals who need personal protective equipment or PPE, as well as charities, lots of different kinds of charities that are making sure that people have food and housing and clothing, and that their bills are paid, and all sorts of things to support people during this pandemic. So if you have the dollar to give, I would much rather that first dollar go there. If you've got another dollar and you want to support independent pagan media, I am absolutely glad to welcome you all onto Patreon, get you guys some treats for supporting independent pagan media at patreon.com/incitingprojects. All that being said, let's get to the interview. Meg Ellison, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. It's been a minute since you've been here.
It has been. Thank you very much for having me back.
Oh my gosh, it's my honor and privilege and pleasure to have you back. So thank you so much for taking some of your busy time during quarantine to spend a little time inciting a riot today. Meg, what's been going on with you since last we spoke? I mean, last we spoke, we talked about one book. We talked about the book of the Unnamed Midwife. And since then, you've become kind of a big deal, ma'am.
I don't know how big a deal I am. I have a couple more books out since then. I finished the series. So there's a trilogy of books on the road to nowhere. That's been really exciting and rewarding. This year, The Book of Flora, which is the third in the series, was on the honors list for the Otherwise Award. That's for science fiction that focuses on gender. I was extremely honored by that. And I was mentioned among some really great books and stories. That's my second Otherwise, and it's one of my favorite awards of the year. It's not one of the biggest, but it always has the most interesting list of winners. Like, if you really want to get some gender fuckery in your reading, you should read anything that's been nominated for the otherwise. So in 2020, I have two new books coming out. So I've been working on finding ways to promote those in spite of quarantine and the closure of actual bookstores and the closure of libraries and schools and all the places you would normally go to promote a book. And that's been a very fiendishly difficult puzzle to solve.
I personally have experience with that, though, on a much smaller scale. my book came out earlier this year, and it was, had all these plans to do all this lovely marketing and all this stuff, and then this happened. So it's like, please, here's lots of selfies with this book. Please go buy it.
That's pretty much where we're all at. We're all taking selfies with our own books and selfies with our friends' books, like I did with yours.
Yes.
And telling people it's really good. No, seriously, buy it. Maybe not from Amazon. Let me give you some links.
Oh goodness, it's creativity during quarantine is a mess. Good question. I mean, I you know, Instagram, which is just the most honest of places, has told me that right now is the very best time to paint and write and create. Are you finding that that's true? Because I'm finding that that's a dirty lie.
That is indeed a dirty lie. I think that it is easy and simplified to say to yourself, I'm spending more time at home than ever. Mm. I may be furloughed or I may be working slightly fewer hours. At least I'm not taking the hours out of my day that I would to commute. Why don't I take that extra time and be creative? Mm-hmm. That works on paper. It really does. And in real life, you are taking up those extra hours with childcare and managing yourself and trying to escape the existential terror of living through a pandemic and trying to stop doom scrolling and trying to stop doom baking and trying to stop doom napping. It doesn't necessarily translate to a fertile creative time. Even if you have those hours, you may not have the lightning to fill the bottle, you know?
And you know, those of us that write or paint or whatever, you know, that have those creative outlets that require plots. I mean, some of us have creative outlets that are, you know, knitting and crochet and quilting and you know, manual things that require creativity, but don't necessarily require a plot or an original idea. It's difficult because you're the sources of your inspiration are sort of dried up. You can't sort of witness a funny thing on the train and try to dive into that headspace and work your way out via a story or a poem or a scene in a novel.
I've gotten most of my best ideas being out in the city and being influenced by other people. I've very rarely awoken from a dream and said, aha, I have it. So yeah, I find myself somewhat less inspired because of that lack of contact. And I also found myself having to just dig out of a hole of not being able to create anything. I spent the first maybe 3.5 weeks of quarantine really struggling and not being able to return to any of my projects in progress or come up with anything new. I really had to work through whether I thought life had a point, which seems like a too far reach, but honestly, if you're an artist or, you know, an existential thinker, it's impossible not to go that direction. Mm-hmm. So I finally had to come back to the place where I understood that it may not have a point, and it may not outlast me, and it may certainly not outlast humanity, and probably the earth is going to swallow up the sun and we're never getting off this rock. And if all that is true, do I still want to write?
Do you find it ironic, in an Alanis Morissette ironic kind of way, and an irony that may not actually be an irony, that you quite literally wrote the book on a pandemic that sort of ends life as we know it, and then created this beautiful story after the fact that spanned three novels and has won awards and has allowed you to become a full-time author. Did you find it ironic that now you're sort of living this story and it's not quite the enchanting tale you dreamed up?
It is deeply ironic, but it's also It's also kind of great that the pandemic that I imagined is much worse than the one I'm living in. I imagined a higher death toll. I imagined a swifter breakdown of the rules of society. I imagined a much more gendered apocalypse, which, frankly, I don't want to live through. Mm. That is not a good time. It was really interesting to see the way people have been characterizing the apocalypse for themselves. There's a creator who I really admire, another writer named Lindsay Ellis, who tweeted the other day a picture from where she lives in L.A., and it was the sun setting behind palm trees and a huge outdoor banner, you know, the kind that you just sort of lash to trees or light posts, that says margaritas, delivery, or to go. And she's like, this is not the apocalypse the way any of us imagined it. And that's been true. Like, our way of life has ground to a halt. It does feel like the world is ending. There is a very dangerous pandemic on, and things are weirder than I or any other writer was able to conceive. Mm-hmm. What we imagined was, although chaotic and difficult and deadly, logical based on what we expected. Mm-hmm. And now we're in a pandemic style apocalypse that no one, literally no one, has ever imagined before. So it has been ironic and bizarre. Yes.
Yeah. In some ways, the pandemic, the apocalypse that we're currently in here is both much more gentle and much more shocking in at the same exact time. I mean, you know, I don't think that anybody thought, oh, okay, well, once the apocalypse happens, we're going to make sure that there's a designated person in the neighborhood to go get all the groceries for the elderly this week, and we're going to be setting up these Zoom happy hours and finding these really lovely ways of giving away our art online and teaching classes and all of this stuff, and also at the same time being this horrible capitalist wasteland where we have commodified, you know, bodies and workers and insist that they go back to work. And so in some ways, that whole capitalist wasteland feels like an apocalyptic trope. But there's also this really beautiful thing.
It's definitely happening on both sides. You're absolutely right. Like, I don't think anybody's bingo card is exactly filled out, because I have expected, and I have noticed for a long time, big political factions saying things like, it's more important for the economy to work than for poor people or old people to live. Like, that's not new. It's just being stated more baldly in this period than ever before. And at the same time, yeah, it's been really great to see neighborhoods band together and small charities spin up and people find ways to keep their local businesses, local restaurants and local galleries running. And it has been, at the risk of being extremely cliche, the best of times and the worst of times.
So let's talk about some of the art that you have coming out. You have a novel coming out called Finding Layla.
I do.
I love the cover.
Thank you.
We love a pretty cover.
Incredible. Oh, it's so good. I've been lucky every time with cover art design, but literally every time I've seen a reveal, I have gasped. Like, this one is really good.
Tell me about Finding Layla. Now, I could be wrong because I didn't actually write this note down, but did you write this before Midwife?
Layla is not older than Midwife, although it is quite old. I wrote Midwife in 2013. And I believe I wrote Layla in 2015. For all of you who want to be authors, keep track of how many years that is, because getting published is a journey.
Yes.
It takes
yes,
a long
come
time.
Through, to... author journey.
It takes a long time to be done, and it takes a long time to rewrite, and it takes a long time to find an agent and find a publisher. And it's a significant investment, and it doesn't always pay you a year's salary either. So you just got to keep grinding and you keep writing. Anyway, I wrote Layla in probably 2015, and I trunked it because I didn't think it was publishable. Mm. My agent at the time wasn't enthusiastic about it, and it is a work of fiction, and there is no one in it who is based on any living person or dead person, but it is very much taken from my own personal experience. It's the experience of a kid who's on their own at a really young age. So in some ways, Layla is the most personal thing I've ever written. So I feel nervous and vulnerable about it in a way that I have not felt about a book thus far. So it'll be a new experience.
What about the book makes you feel so vulnerable?
I wrote about some things that I'm sure have happened to other people. But when I was growing up, it felt as if they were only happening to me. And I often have difficulty relating to people when they talk about their normalized experiences of growing up. There are a couple of foundational pieces of being a child to which I have no means of relating whatsoever. So I often find myself saying ridiculous things like, oh yeah, that makes sense because your parents liked you. Or, oh right, you were never homeless as a teenager. Right, right, right. So that's different for you. Just really basic things. So I wanted to write about some of those more difficult experiences so that I could, on the one hand, reach people who grew up something like I did, who experienced the kind of foundational chaos that I did, and say, hey, not just you. And also so that I could reach people who are searching for ways to experience empathy to a life that was very different from theirs. So the weird thing about that is I love getting fan mail, and I love people tweeting at me and telling me that they liked my book. And I love seeing people's reviews, and it's all great, but it's also, it is very strange to be known in that way. And it is doubly strange when the work is very personal, when people look at it and they know something about you, or they think they know something about you. So putting this book out and saying, yeah, it's not autobiographical, but it is based on my adolescence.
Yeah.
Means I will be facing that differently and more than ever. And that's a trial.
When people write of childhood, I think they get really concerned that they're going to fall into a trope of, oh gosh, this story's been told before. One of the best pieces of advice that I was ever given about talking to children way back when I was a teenager, I was in this peer counseling group. It's this national organization called PALS, Peer Assistance and Leadership. So you're given some sort of, like, I don't know, the ER trauma quick and dirty equivalent of counseling training. And then you're sort of it's a big brothers, big sisters kind of thing. And then you're sort of assigned kids where teachers from throughout the school district recommend a kid that might be in their class, that might, you know, be going through something or seem like they just need somebody to talk to or something. So, you know, looking, you think that you're this much older, wiser person who can convey all of this wisdom and grace upon this young kid. And looking back, I'm like, I was 17. What in the hell did I know? I had no business going and talking to an 8-year-old. But, you know, I did find it incredibly valuable. And given the career path that I thought I was going to be on, it was good experience. But all that to say that during the training to become a peer counselor, one of the best pieces of advice that I was ever given by my own teacher was the reason why, for example, that 8-year-old might act like the world is ending because their dog died is because for an 8-year-old, the world ends when their dog dies.
Right. The world is much smaller to an 8-year-old, and the important things in it are much nearer.
Correct. Because they haven't experienced death of any kind before. And so the death of this dog, the death of this puppy, the death of this whatever, is all of death for them. It's all of death. You know, the joy is all of joy, and the sadness is all of sadness. And so when you're writing or creating, or, you know, and you're thinking of children, it's okay sometimes to allow for tropes, because for them it's still the biggest thing in the whole wide world.
That's the thing.
And I think that as adults we want to minimize that, because, well, it's just your dog dying, man. I mean, it's sad, but, like, the world doesn't end. Right. And you forget that when you were 8, the world did end.
The world absolutely did. Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing to be nervous about is, you know, the book is ostensibly meant for kids who are 14, 15, 16, and they have to filter this through the lens of their own experience. They have to think about how they relate to being this kid or knowing somebody like this kid. And I remember how desperately I searched for books like that when I was that age. I remember looking for books about kids stuck in the foster system or kids who are out on their own. And there just weren't that many. There are more now because YA literature has become this incredibly robust place where difficult issues are tackled in all these different books. But when I was young, it was much fewer.
I want to talk about YA literature for a moment because, you know, I've been an adult for a while.
No kidding.
As much as I don't
you
want
don't
to be.
You don't look like it. No.
Oh, you are getting that check in the mail soon. You know, and so I have been reading very adult books for quite a while and taking myself very seriously as a reader. And, you know, I got reintroduced to YA literature, I think, like most of us did, once some of these, the big post-apocalyptic movies came out. You know, maybe I should read The Hunger Games. Maybe I should read Twilight or whatever. But in the last couple of years, I have gone back and dabbled in just sort of generic YA story fare and seen that it's a lot more queer and a lot more diverse than certainly it was when I was reading YA literature. But what I have found is that when you compare the stories and the characters to the authors that are writing them, there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect. You know, there's been a push in recent years to write really inclusive stories. And I'm specifically thinking of genres that, you know, appeal to teens and young adults and, you know, romance and science fiction and stuff, which are stories that you write as well.
Absolutely.
But the authors themselves are not often writing from personal experience. And because of that, the diverse characters themselves tend to fall into these really cliche molds, these really cliche storylines. Or these really interesting novel stories seem to have diversity thrust upon them, and the characters themselves seem more like placeholders than humans. You have gotten a lot of acclaim for writing both original stories that don't fall into tropes, and also compelling, humanized, diverse characters that may or may not look like you. So how do you walk the line just as a creator, as a writer, of writing authentic characters while also telling a compelling story?
This is one of the most difficult questions that comes up when writers gather to talk. And it always comes up because everybody is trying to figure out how to thread this needle. Everybody wants to write a lush and realistic, diverse world. And everybody is scared to death of doing that wrong. I think that there are a number of things that writers can do to be better at that, because we're all going to write people who don't look like us. Like, there's a difference between populating your world with realistic characters who behave like real people and putting yourself completely out of your lane and telling a story that doesn't belong to you. That's an important distinction. But beyond that, I think that there are writers who realize that if they wanted to write a story about their kid's high school, that their kid's high school is more diverse and queerer than theirs was. And they can see in at least a superficial manner that it is a different world than it used to be. And then where it breaks down is the vast majority of writers, of people who get published, especially people who get big deals, are white. Publishing is an extremely white business. I know that there are a lot of initiatives to fix that, but the pipeline has not been primed yet, and we are still living in that world. And as a result, the people who get awards, the people who get recognition, the people who end up on the bestseller lists are also white. There are other books out there. You can track down books and read from the point of view of people with disabilities and trans people and queer people and people of color and black identified people of color. But you have to work to go get them because they're not on the top shelf at Barnes and Noble. They're not making the lists that you're looking for. They're not, you know, getting the mentions in Publishers Weekly that they should. So you have to, as a writer, be a reader first and foremost, and you have to commit to reading broadly and reading differently and not just reading the same thing everybody else who's talking at the water cooler is reading. And this is especially true if you want to write diverse works. One of the easiest things you can do for yourself, and say you live in a very rural and isolated area and you don't have the good fortune to have a diverse group of friends from whom you can learn and experience and grow, you can at least buy these books and read them and understand a little bit more of that point of view. And writers fail to do that all the time. People fail to do that. I can't tell you how many times a writer has said, like, oh, there isn't a book like this. There isn't a book about a black lesbian who wins a skateboarding competition. There absolutely fucking is. You just haven't found it. You're not looking for it. You're not looking at indie publishers. You're not looking at smaller lists and smaller houses. You're looking at the same books that have the little orange ribbon on Amazon, and they just don't perform the same way because of the inherent unfairness in our system. So I think it's all of these things. You have to hope for and cultivate and be cool enough to have a diverse group of friends. You have to understand that people who aren't like you are people. That's like the whole job of being a human. You have to develop empathy and develop clarity of voice by reading people who are not like you. And then, for God's sake, telling people that that book was good. Mm-hmm. Write reviews and boost it and get the word out, because those folks are struggling to keep publishing and to keep their work out there. I can't tell you how many Black writers I know, even in the Bay Area, who got burned so badly by traditional publishing that they went to self-publishing, that they developed their own audience and their own interior networks of getting covers designed and getting PR done and getting placement done, because it's just not a friendly place. And then that makes their books even harder to find and isolates them further and makes it even less likely that the bigger writers of the world are going to pick them up, because it's so clearly branded as, maybe this isn't for you. So yeah, that's a struggle. That's a huge struggle, and there's no simple answer to it. It's a very nuanced problem, and in order to get better at it, you have to examine your own racism, your own investment in racism, your own ways of benefiting from systematic and generational white supremacy. And I mean, you have to start there, and most people aren't willing to do any of that. And then you have to build on it by being a better reader and a better consumer of books and a better friend and a better member of a literary community. And all that is work, and it's hard work to do, and people don't want to do it.
It is a lot of hard work to do, and it's not just novels, it's not just fiction. The problem of unpacking internalized racism, homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, xenophobia, I mean the problem of unpacking privilege and stacking it on the floor around you and saying, okay, well, why was this here? Why was this here? Why was this here? And then unpacking all those little threads and unwinding them, and realize that you are always going to be an imperfect ally and an imperfect creator. And starting from a place of genuine seekership of learning and getting better, it doesn't just lie in YA or science fiction or novels or, you know, I was talking about it earlier this week, you know, Pagan Publishing has this problem. And there are a lot of different kinds of books and genres where the voices are white. The voices are, you know, very privileged.
Very privileged, straight, coming from money, coming from, you know, I have an uncle in the literary business. Like, I can't tell you how disillusioning it's been growing up. I grew up extremely poor, and I really thrive on stories of people who grew up something like me and made something of themselves. And every time I see like a breakout novelist and they're like, you know, came out of nowhere, this voice from disadvantaged whatever, I go and look it up. And they went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and their parents are professors of English at a college. And like, that's not coming out of nowhere, folks. Everybody should own up to whatever privilege they're dragging into the game.
It's like the headlines that call Kylie Jenner the youngest self-made billionaire.
That word no longer has any meaning.
And I'm just like, I don't understand. None of these words are in the same sentence.
I object all the time to people referring to me as self-made, and like, they're like, well, you know, you dropped out of high school and you went through college on your own. And I have been on my own since I was 14, and I have faced significant disadvantages, and I still don't use the label self-made because I made myself with the goddamn Pell Grant.
Sure.
Like, I'm made out of taxpayer money. I made out of the free lunch program. You know, I made out of the Lions Club paying for my glasses when I was 12 years old. That's not self-made.
And I think that it's important that, I mean, even somebody who may not have originally considered themselves as coming from privilege, I think it's important that you unpack those things and recognize, okay, here's the ways that I have a leg up here.
Right.
And
right, simple things you might not have been like, did you not experience housing insecurity as a kid? Did your parents stay married? Like, were you on the free lunch program? Like, you got help. A lot of us got help, and almost all of us had some advantages. I think the problem with the discussion around privilege is that people feel invalidated in the ways that they have struggled, in the ways that they have been in pain when they hear that they have privilege. I think we have to start by acknowledging, like, everybody has a unique struggle. Everybody has experienced pain. Everybody's had difficulty. I am sure Kylie Jenner has had terrible days where she lays in bed and cries about how fucking
I can't imagine having the spotlight that she has. And
absolutely not.
Having the things written about me that I'm sure she does. And having people like me think of people like her in certain ways. And I can't imagine what that's like.
And, you know, most of the ways that she and her sisters are discussed are extremely sexist. And, like, that has a terrible toll on your mental health. So, like, yes, that entire family is insanely privileged. They are insulated from the consequences of their actions and from most of the adverse things that people have to contend with by layers of generational wealth, by their fame, by all these things. But when we discuss people's privilege, I think it would be helpful to us, as distasteful as it may be, and I'm not asking people of color to do this labor, but I'm saying, if you're a white person and you're trying to tell your fellow white people about the privilege that they experience, start by validating the places where they have had things difficult for them. Like, you can say, I know you grew up poor. I know your dad joined the army because there weren't any jobs and there was nothing else he could do. And that meant you grew up in a single parent household. And I know that you haven't always had health insurance and you probably have bad teeth and you've had to live really close to the railroad tracks your whole life. Like, I can acknowledge the ways in which you have struggled. And also, there are some invisible advantages that you may not be aware of. Here are how things might have been different for you if you'd been born to a different family.
I was talking about this earlier this week with a friend, you know, mostly because of the discussion that I mentioned earlier about Pagan Publishing. But, you know, I said, you know, I grew up white and gay in a town of 585 people with 9 Baptist churches. You know, I was put into conversion therapy. I had hands laid on me. I've gone through my share.
Yeah.
But I look at someone like my husband, who didn't only just grow up young and gay, but a young gay Mexican immigrant currently living in Trump's America and having to unpack the internalized racism, the internalized homophobia, the generational homophobia. I mean, it's just so many extra layers of things that I never even conceived of having to go through.
Right. You both had it tough. And
correct.
Inarguably had it tougher.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important when trying to create authentically, when mm-hmm. trying to tell authentic stories or make authentic podcasts, get authentic voices on, you know, whatever it is that you're putting out into the world.
Yeah.
You know, that you come from a place of honesty about who you are, where you've come from, you know, and maybe when it's time for you to not have that microphone, maybe when it's time to step aside and hand that microphone to somebody else or use the privilege and platform that you've built, such as it is.
Absolutely.
You know, to give space to others. So, you know, in that vein, I know that you are a big advocate of, you know, handing the microphone off to others, quite literally.
As much as I can be, yes.
So why do you find it so important? Not that I've just spoon-fed you the answer here. But, you know, I know that in the Bay Area you do a lot of, you know, mic nights and short storytelling and things like that. Tell me more about that. Speak to some of the big open mic circles.
So when we're not in quarantine, I produce a monthly show called Clitterary Salon. And it is dedicated to women's art and writing and performances. Although our performers don't have to be women and they don't have to be female identified, it's not about that. We just wanted to start from a place of, this is what we're focused on. Mm-hmm. And my fellow co-producers and I have a number of things we've committed to when we first began, that we would never do an all-white show, that we would try not to do all cis shows, and that we would make sure that we found marginalized creators who we could put money in their hands. So we don't ask anybody to perform for free. Mm-hmm. We sell people's merch for them. We promote their works for them. And we make sure that they get an equal cut of how many tickets we sell. So as producers, most of us don't draw any income, although sometimes we have to get reimbursed. And the most important thing for me is to find like these great writers, these incredible poets, these up-and-comers, these novelists and performers and singers in Oakland, and get them in front of an audience who might not have known about them otherwise and put some fucking cash in their hands. Mm-hmm. And that's been, that has mostly been rewarding in that I've gotten exposed to new forms of art and to new readers that I didn't know that I should be, writers that I didn't know I should be reading yet. And I love being able to do that. I love that my own small celebrity might get people to buy tickets and you know, and see Nazila Jameson, who I think is the best poet in Oakland, although there's some other poets who are going to be mad at me for saying that. And the best thing we can do as artists is to cross-pollinate each other. Like, I'm bringing you my audience, you're bringing me your audience, and I know that so many of our performers have done that exact favor for me, too. Mm-hmm. So it has been very mutual give and take, and it's one of the most enjoyable things I do. It is real work, especially in finding and maintaining venue spaces in a place where real estate comes at such a heavy cost, but it is one of the best things I do. And I try to, in all of my work online, when I review short stories on my blog or when I tweet about other people's books or when I write book reviews for outlets like Tor.com or Salon or whoever will pay me for a review, that I talk about the work of marginalized creators. Like, there's a bunch of straight white dudes who have books coming out who do not need my help.
Y'all are fine. You're good.
They're going to be fine. They really are. But there's also a bunch of trans people with their debut novels coming out and a bunch of non-white writers who have fantastically original work that you haven't read 500 times before, who fucking need reviews, who need people to talk about their work. And that's what I want to do. That's where I want to focus my attention and energy. And I'm trying to remember who said it, but there's some philosopher who said that the primary function of freedom is how you get other people free. And I have always found that to be true. There is no point in being free yourself. It's like, you know, there's the scene in the movie where somebody escapes from jail and they just happen to get their cell door open, and you always see them have the moment. Like, should I take advantage of the time that I have and run? Or should I go back and hit the button or steal the keys and open up everybody else's cell too? That's the moment that tells you who you are. Mm-hmm. Who you should be is the person who goes back and gets the fucking keys and opens up everybody else's cell. I understand life is difficult and scary, and it makes sense to run. But freedom is not worth a damn unless you're freeing somebody else.
You know, when you hear fire, are you running into it, or are you running away from it?
And that's it.
Both are valid, it's about what you do in either direction that's important.
Yep.
And it's about the intention. Are you running into it for yourself, or are you running into it for others? Are you running away for yourself, or are you running away to protect others? I mean, you know, there's validity in both directions.
One of the proudest moments of my life was when I was at UC Berkeley and I was writing for the newspaper there, the Daily Californian, mm-hmm. which is a very distinguished newspaper with a lot of awards and incredible history behind it. And I'm more proud of having been part of that as an organization than almost anything I've done. And there was a day when we had a huge explosion on campus in the steam tunnels underneath. There's a network of tunnels running under the campus that have ventilation and electrical purposes for the most part, but they're huge. Like, they're big enough you can walk through them. Mm-hmm. So anyway, one day there's an explosion in the tunnel because of an electrical issue, and like fire shot out of it, and the cops were like, don't touch the metal gates because they might be electrified. And it was a lot. So we heard it over the police scanner up at the paper's offices, and I saw three or four reporters, and these kids are 18, 19, 20, pick up their cameras, pick up their phones, pick up their notebooks, and run toward the fire. That was the best day. Like, I know they're too young to understand their own mortality, but also they understood that their function as reporters was more important than their personal safety. I saw that over and over. I had to, you know, go call the cops and get them to let go of a photographer who had committed trespassing in order to get the photo that we needed, or had been arrested in protest. My God, that happened like every week. I saw my 19-year-old editor-in-chief come to the door of the paper and tell the police chief that she couldn't come in without a warrant and stand there and take her abuse and continue to refuse. And that job gave me so much to be proud of.
Tell me about Big Girl.
So Big Girl is my short story collection that is released by PM Press, technically this month right now. It's just about out. But with things being as uncertain and in the air as they are, Big Girl is at the printer, and as far as I know, not yet printed. The last word that I have from my publishers is that pre-orders are coming in and that it should ship in June. I really hope that that's the case. Big Girl is some previously published work, including the title story, which was originally published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction in 2018, I think. And some of it is original. There's an original novella in there. There are a set of interviews between myself and one of my great heroes in science fiction, Terry Bisson. Some new short stories and some previously published essays. This is the first time I've had a book that was entirely my own collected works. I've been in a lot of anthologies. I've contributed to a lot of larger works, fiction and nonfiction, but this one's all me. It's my face on the cover. It's very exciting. PM Press was able to put together a special edition of the book because of our unusual circumstances right now. It is the first time I will be available in hardback. There is a very limited run. There are 200 total copies of Big Girl in hardback with an exclusive back cover of a painting by the artist Paul Morton, who was inspired by my story Big Girl to do a painting of a 350-foot tall woman in the bay. super exciting. Really glad to have Paul's contribution on the work, and to have their work next to mine is incredibly humbling. All of the hardback editions will be signed and numbered by me before they get shipped out. So if you want something special, never to be repeated, Meg Ellison ephemera, that's what you want. There's also a paperback edition that is a lot more affordable, and there will be many more of those. And for your listeners, if they would like to buy either one of these, if you use the code BIGGIRL, all caps, no spaces, you get 20% off in checkout. You'll be helping me out as an independent creator, and you'll be helping a local independent anarchist press, PM Press, survive this pandemic and keep publishing subversive works. And other great science fiction authors, like they just published Niecy Shaw and Sam Delaney and Cory Doctorow and Elizabeth Baer and some really amazing authors.
That is amazing. So, you know, the stories, the point of view that you have, you know, calling the book, the collection, I should say, Big Girl, a lot of, at least your social media presence, is in regards to breaking down fat phobia, breaking down issues of size, and promoting body positivity, for whatever that word, that term means these days. What about that terminology, the title, the entire oeuvre is important to you?
It's funny because I know so many fat people who had to do a lot of deeply personal work, especially in their 20s and 30s, to get through all of the programming and expectations people have around body politics and size and whether the world is accepting of you or made for you at all. And I'm no different. I had to struggle through that too. And it is a multifaceted struggle. It's everything from figuring out you don't fit in a commercial airline seat to trying to navigate the politics of desire. Like, why doesn't anybody in porn look like me? Why do people on dating apps feel like they have the right to be abusive toward me? And that has been a huge project of my adulthood, because God knows I didn't have the resources for it as an adolescent. But I found that the more comfortable I have become with myself and the more I've come to know myself, it becomes a very different perspective. I've been able to approach it in my own work with a kind of, not detachment, but let's say contentment. It was for a long time a source of rage for me, and now I feel very over it. I feel like it is a safe subject that is okay to play with, and it is in many ways a source of joy for me. I have a lot of friends who are like big time philosophers, and they're like, oh, I'd be so much happier as a brain in a jar, and they're saying this completely shredded with no body fat, looking like fucking Captain America. And there's such a disconnect, because I love having a body. I get so much pleasure out of it. I get so much enjoyment out of it. I feel very healthy and very centered. And, you know, I really like going out and dancing or hiking or, you know, deriving pleasure from being seen the way that I am. And it is mind-boggling to me that people who actually fit society's expectations of beauty often enjoy it far less. They derive less utility from it. Mm. And the difference isn't really whether you're conventionally beautiful or not. The difference is whether you feel like your body belongs to you.
Mm.
So I've gone through all of this and written about it and read about it. And most importantly, read other fat writers who have talked openly and honestly about their journey with it. I've read, you know, Roxane Gay and Carmen Maria Machado and Virgie Tovar and people who've dealt with it in very different ways and gone along with them for their journeys and come back to this place where it belongs to me. And I'm able to write about it in a way that signals to people that it belongs to me, that I am not unhappy to be who I am, that I wish chairs didn't have fixed arms that dug themselves into the sides of my ass. But other than that, I wouldn't change me. I would change the chair.
I love that. I wouldn't change me. I would change the chair.
That's
the chair
it.
Is what is not serving society. It's not my body that's not serving society. It's not my body that's not serving me. It's the chair that's not serving me.
I have serving body every day. Fuck the chair.
Yeah.
I was at the Bay Area Book Festival, and there was this fantastic panel of body positive writers talking about writing about fatness, writing about disability, writing about the queer body and the monstrous body. And it was so eye-opening and so good. And the caliber of conversation was so high. And Dr. Gay was one of the panelists. You know, she brings this incredible aura everywhere she goes. And the very first question from the audience, because it always is, was a tall, straight-looking white dude. And the first question out of his mouth was, okay, like body positivity or whatever, but if you had the magic power to snap your fingers and change yourself to an ideal body, wouldn't you do it?
Oh, God. Is right. he still alive?
Barely.
Oh, God.
No.
Is he, like, on a spit somewhere? Basted.
The poet Sonia Renee Taylor was on the panel. She wrote The Body Is Not an Apology. And she is a quick-thinking fucking genius, and she grabbed the microphone closest to her and dragged it toward her face. She was like, the fact that you would ask that question to this panel after that discussion tells you everything you need to know about what we're up against. And no, I wouldn't change a goddamn thing. It's not my problem to change. I would change the world that doesn't accept us. The room just broke open. It was so, so good.
I relate a lot to the body positive movement. I grew up with severe body dysmorphia, and it took many, 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 many years to unpack where it came from and how it came about, and to realize that a lot of it was not just internalized homophobia, but externalized homophobia. And growing up where I grew up, and you know, people being horrible and terrible and awful. Finding any little thing to break down about me, you know, so all of the things that I now love about myself, you know, I used to say, oh God, I can't wait to grow up and get a nose job. I can't wait to grow up and get my ears pinned back. I can't wait to grow up and fix my chin. I can't wait to grow up and fix my chest because my rib cage is inverted. And so I spent 25 years of my life without ever showing my skin anywhere ever at all. And, you know, I remember there was an incredibly traumatic experience where my family decided before I went off to college that we're going to take one last family vacation to Dollywood in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, for
Definitely.
Some reason Definitely. I cannot fathom. And we went to Dolly's Splashing Mountains, which is a delightful double entendre in and of itself.
Oh, yes.
And we had to go down a slide, and they wouldn't let me wear my t-shirt on the slide. And I was an 18-year-old grown-ass person breaking down sobbing in front of hundreds of people because these assholes would not let me just keep my shirt on going down this slide. And I remember so many years of hating my body and hating it and just feeling like it was this horrible, horrible thing. And it took so many years to unpack where all that came from.
It does.
And, you know, I also look back and recognize the privilege of once I started understanding it and once I started enjoying my body, that now, you know, people that look at me in a certain way, and now my body is viewed in a certain way. And, you know, hearing comments sometimes and seeing what people say about it and seeing what people say about me, it feels weird because, one, you enjoy it. You know, once you come to love your body, or at least appreciate your body, you're like, ah, I'm a fucking beautiful being. I'm a beautiful, sexual, creative, incredible being. And still, when somebody gets just a little too thirsty, a little too complimentary, it's like, gross, stop, back off. This is not okay. And then it's like, I want to wear nothing but quilts. To just do nothing but cover up.
I very rarely have that reaction. I can take very specific compliments, and I'm pretty okay with it. There is the odd occasion of encountering a true fat fetishist, which is a different experience and in some ways very dehumanizing. Mm. But for the most part, compliments intended to be compliments are fine with me. I don't run from my quilts too easily.
But that to say, you know, body positivity, and I said earlier, for whatever that term means.
Yeah, it's a damaged term, but I know what you mean.
I was going to say, I mean, do you find that term's become overused or commodified? Personally, I feel like it's become commodified.
Heavily commodified.
I feel like it's become akin to the word self-care, the term self-care, which doesn't really mean anything, because self-care has come to mean a face mask and Netflix and rosé on a Friday night. And I'm like, no, self-care is going to a therapist and seriously unpacking your internalized homophobia.
The thing is, it's all of those things. Just like body positivity is a huge umbrella, and it covers a lot of things. And body positivity and BOPO have, for the most part, become watchwords for people who are doing the work that is just as difficult to reclaim their body, to come to kind of peace with how they look and how they feel, and how they feel that they don't measure up to whatever societal standard they feel that they should have measured up to. And that is super important work, and I don't want to take it away from them. I will say that there is a marked difference in the discourse and usage of body positivity and BOPO in the major platforms, like, say, in Instagram. And you're much more likely to see the BOPO hashtag on, like, someone who clearly works out a lot and is struggling with maybe 15 pounds, or someone who is in really good shape and has stretch marks or other forms of damage from having given birth. Like, it is typically the watchword of minor flaws and not of, say, exclusion from major parts of society. It is for that reason that a lot of people prefer the term fat acceptance, because it says exactly what it is on the can. And it is really different from an Instagrammer who feels like she does not have large enough breasts being body positive than saying, I can't buy clothes for my body in a regular store, and I can't get on an airplane, and people are openly antagonistic to me about the shape of my ass, like, on the street. Those are different experiences. So while I don't want to take that term away from anybody who needs it, and I want to honor everybody's journey with their body is just as important, and everybody's is difficult. I'm not saying some people's isn't more difficult, but sometimes we need different umbrellas, and I need a bigger umbrella than most Instagrammers, and that is okay. We're all going to stay out of the rain.
And I think that that's a gorgeous example of the intersectionality of movements like this, of, like, absolutely, what we were talking about earlier. You know, yeah, I was a awkward gay kid in a small East Texas town, but the real work of unpacking what that means means that I need to accept that there were lots and lots of ways that I had it better, and you know, relaying, okay, if I'm body positive, then that means that all bodies need to be positive, but then doing the further work of not just thinking that idea, but what would it mean for all bodies to feel valid, to be valid in society. And I love what you said earlier about realizing that it's the chair that doesn't work, not the body that doesn't work. We don't all need to, you know, the idea of getting fit, the idea of getting healthy. Right. You know, I remember years ago I had Sophia Catherine on, Dr. Sophia Catherine now, on the show to talk about disability. And you know, she always said she gave me some wonderful aha moments around the idea that so much of our culture is around healing and fitness and
right.
and being well. She's like, you know, people lay hands on you to heal you of not being able to walk or not being able to hear or something like that. She's like, I don't need to be healed from that. I'm fine as is. It's
That's
you
exactly
that.
it.
That's it's you that needs to do the unpacking of why you feel so uncomfortable with allowing me to exist in the body that I have. Why you feel so uncomfortable at having to put the ramp down. Just put the damn ramp down.
Right.
Just make the chair that fits.
Right. That's it. And that there is a struggle even among people in the fat acceptance movement to qualify those things because people are so anxious to be one of the good ones. And people in the disability movement have the same problem, like saying, well, I'm one of the good ones because I don't force people to accommodate me, or I'm one of the good ones because I'm healthy while being fat. I'm not diabetic. I don't have high blood pressure, you know, any of those typically aligned with fatness diseases. And the thing is, you don't owe anybody health. You don't owe anybody wellness. You're not better because you were lucky. And everybody deserves to be accommodated and everybody deserves to fit. And there is no reason as part of your journey toward acceptance of yourself or acceptance of other people that you need to separate based on things that ultimately aren't within your control. Like health is not your job. Wellness is not your job. And you're not better than anybody else who doesn't have those things.
There's the unpacking that all of us need to do about, you know, acceptable fatness.
Exactly.
It's Beyonce is,
oh,
is acceptable fatness. That's
right.
that's what, you know, most people think, or at least thought of at one time as the big girl. It's
right.
just the girl with the larger hips and the bigger boobs and yep. very curvy. And, you know, you just start, Jennifer Hudson was the fat girl on Dreamgirls and you just like look at her body and it's like, oh, what are you even talking about? But it's the idea that the acceptable fat girl is just the girl who's curvy and has that hourglass figure, but just in different sizes. And it's recognizing that's not what fat is. That's not what bodies look like.
No, it isn't. I mean, great for you if that's your shape, and please enjoy it and get as much joy out of it as you can. But I think the first time I really saw a plus size clothing line using any model who wasn't just like a very curvy size 18 to be like, we have plus sizes, is Universal Standard. Universal Standard has hired models who can actually wear like a size 40 women's jeans, and people with limb differences and little people and very different body types to show how truly universal their basic wardrobe pieces are. And it's honestly, it's revolutionary. Like, it's so unusual to see somebody without that basic hourglass, very femme-coded shape modeling clothes that I might one day put on my body. It is astonishing.
What does representation mean to you? I mean, what does, you know, what does it mean to see yourself on TV? You know, I'm thinking of, she's certainly been problematic in other instances, but this was a great interview where Ashley Graham, who's become a you know, a big, so to speak, model that, you know, is very famous and now, and, you know, she was a very slim, slender model. And, you know, she got bigger over the years and she's been very celebrated for her body. But I do remember one interview where she said, well, yeah, I have made a career off of my body and my curves, but I also have to recognize that the same body that celebrated that the same body shape that celebrated when it's me in front of the camera is the same exact body that Black women have had to overcome and be told is wrong and be told is unhealthy and is the reason why doctors don't listen to them. And you know, that was a rare moment where I felt she was very self-aware. And it was such a good interview. So I started this discussion with you to talk about how you write authentically. But what does authentic representation look like to you? What do you look for when you are partaking of media, books and TV and movies?
It's complicated, and I think that it is important for us to remember that people often see themselves where you maybe didn't mean for them to see themselves. So I want to keep the idea open that representation might look very different to you than you expect it to. I've read the point of view of a lot of kids who grew up on the autism spectrum who saw themselves in characters that were written to be striving toward humanity, like android characters, like Data on Star Trek. And I don't think that when the writers created that character, that's what they were looking for at all. But that doesn't make it any less valuable. So I've loved things like that. When I am trying to write characters and things that encapsulate my own experience, it's often a very fragmented view of that experience. Like, there are ways in which I can write my experience as a fat person that exclude my experience as a queer person, because fatness is so differently coded on the heterosexual side of existence. And there are ways in which I've written about being like a gifted kid and a kid who was in like the gifted program, who was typically an accelerated learning and accelerated education, that is really different from my experience of poverty. And then you take those things and you try to look at the ways that they intersect, the way that your different identifications influence each other and your own intersectional experience. And that is a whole different kind of representation. Like, what if both things at once? What if gifted and very poor? What if fat and also queer? So it ends up being like a really complicated dance, and one that you won't always get right, and one that when you do get it right, people will see themselves in it who you weren't expecting. And that's a gift. Like, that is a huge gift. I have occasionally gotten fan mail from people where I'm like, really, you read my book? Because I didn't write it for you. But they saw themselves in it, and it was incredibly valuable. And in the end, one of the oddest things about becoming a professional writer, and one of the things I didn't understand until I had been published, was that as much of yourself as you put into your books and as much work as you pour into it, what you write is about 40% of a reader's experience, if that. 40 if you're lucky, 40 if you're a good writer. 60% is what they bring to it, what parts of themselves they project onto it, and that you don't have any control over that. It's why people have such a vastly different experience of reading the same thing. So I think representation is 60% that. It's what people project onto what they're seeing. It's kids seeing themselves in Lieutenant Commander Data. Mm-hmm. And that is chaotic and unpredictable and totally beautiful.
When I give writing feedback, and it mostly it lies in poetry, but you know, I always encourage people that empathy lies in specificity.
It does.
When you want to write about I don't know, let's use a generic example, the horrible breakup, you know, capital T, capital H, capital B, the horrible one, breakup.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's written about the horrible breakup. Why was your breakup horrible? What was the specific thing?
Yeah.
You know, oh, he threw dollar bin DVDs at the wall, you know, whatever.
Right.
You might not have ever had dollar bin DVDs thrown at the wall, but you understand what that feels like.
Right.
And
that's
the problem
what makes
is
it
that
real.
So many writers, think that they can write in the generic and that people will just get it.
No, that's the trick, man. It has to be specific for that projection to work. You can't just say the breakup was horrible. You have to say he had my dog put down while I was at work.
And the great thing is that I have no idea what that feels like, and yet I know exactly what that feels like.
Exactly.
I know exactly what that feels like. And that's where, you know, that's why.
Right.
I have such an issue with, I guess to bring it full circle, such an issue sometimes with straight people playing gay, or with, you know, Emma Stone playing a half Asian woman or something. You know, it's just, God love Emma Stone. I certainly love Emma Stone.
No,
but why I feel like stories and information needs to be passed on by people that live in that community, for which that's not just information, for which that's not just a story, for which it is
lacks that specificity.
A very important, very specific part of themselves that they are gifting you with.
Right.
Because when when a gay person plays a gay person, they can tell that coming out story in such a tangible way.
Absolutely.
And a unique way that it feels like, you know, people that have never had to come out, people that will never have to come out, right, still can at least understand something about the difficulty of it.
Right.
And I
and
think
there's an authenticity to that there is no substitute for. You can't fake it.
You can't. You can't at all. And
nope. And
you know, that's why I think that it's so important to be very, very careful about the art that you create in the world, the characters that we create, the tropes that we put into them, the storylines that we tell, because if you're just inserting a character, if you're just inserting a type,
right,
it does none of the things that you're wanting it to.
Right.
Meg Ellison,
yes,
thank you so much for spending your time with me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for providing me with such stimulating topics of conversation. It's always a joy.
Oh, thank you. I thought I was going to have all of these questions for you. I've written zero questions. I'm just happy that we can talk.
Yeah, we never have a lack of things to talk about. I wasn't worried about it in the slightest.
Meg, thank you so much for coming on the show. Big, big, big magic and good luck on Finding Layla and Big Girl. Big Girl is coming out later this month, and Finding Layla comes out in June, I think you said?
September,
later this year.
Later this year. Maybe by then some bookstores will be open, but
hopefully
I guess we'll see.
You can go to a bookstore and find Layla. Ha ha.
Hey.
Ha.
Nice.
Meg, if people want to get a little bit more of you right now, where can they find you online?
I am always at my real name, so I'm Meg Ellison on Twitter. My website is megellison.com. I am Megan Ellison on Instagram, slight variation. But if you Google Meg Ellison, ELISON, you will get me.
Well, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for all of the work that you do. And I am going to say something that Roxane Gay, who we were just talking about, said yesterday, day before, that I thought was a lovely aha moment for myself. You know, thank you for the labor of discussing some of these topics. I think
she is really good about that. Yes,
she's
thank you
so
for the
good
fame.
About that. And I had never seen somebody not just thank you for the information, thank you for your story, thank you for your take, but thank you for the emotional labor that it took to teach me topics that I teach me information that I had no right to know and you didn't need to provide. So thank you.
She's an incredible role model. Thank you for the same.
Well, rioters, thank you so much for joining me here. Episode 143, Inciting Meg Ellison's Riot. I could not be prouder of the discussion that we had today. I hope that this conversation doesn't end here. Please send in your thoughts about any of the topics that we covered today to Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. Of course, show notes, as well as links to all of Meg's goodness, are also going to be at the website, incitingariot.com. You can find me on social media. I'm at Inciting a Riot on Twitter, Inciting a Riot podcast on Facebook. You can find me Firelight, F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, on Twitter and all of the social medias as well. And again, just a quick plug, if you do feel like supporting independent pagan media, you can give as little as a dollar a month at patreon.com/incitingprojects. Thank you guys so much. Meg, thank you again for your advocacy and for your brilliant work and for coming on the show today. Good luck with the book and good luck with the promotion. I hope that all of you guys out there are staying safe in this time of quarantine. I know by this time, a lot of states have started to reopen, or at least to reopen some parts of their economy. I hope that as you guys start venturing out into the world, that you're doing so safely, and that you and your family are protected. So anyways, I'm going to leave you guys, but as always, I will leave you with love and light, Firelight.